welcome to the Troubleshooters Podcast with me, your host, Mike McGrath. Now, today's guest, Nick Armstrong, is a genuine entrepreneur. He started his first business at uni before selling it just a year later. He's gone on to start multiple ventures, and he's currently just launched his latest venture, Chirp, which is a new technology that helps organizations enhance and improve their revenues by harnessing AI to improve their pipeline conversion. Quick shout out to our sponsors, Oasis Partners, corporate advice with a practical bias. Now, the guys at Oasis know a thing or two about getting a deal done. So if you're considering an exit, talk to the team at Oasis, over 500 deals done and still counting. Nick Armstrong, welcome to the Troubleshooters Podcast.
Thanks, Mike.
Look, thanks for coming in today. We're very grateful to have you join us. Now, you are the entrepreneur's entrepreneur, for sure. And you've been on a hell of an entrepreneurial journey, haven't you, since you left school, pretty much, since you left uni. In fact, you started a business at uni, didn't you?
I did. I didn't know any better. I was actually taking advantage of the free office space at Sydney Uni upstairs.
Is that right? Look, we'll come back to that. I know that you've just launched a venture called Chirp, which is very exciting. We've just been chatting about it. It's a sort of AI. I mean, you can sort this out later, but I'm going to butcher this. But it's effectively a cool AI tool that really helps quantify and qualify the quality of your pipeline.
It's a co-pilot for sales teams. It does that. It does a bit more than that.
Okay. Let's not get into that now. Come back to it. I want to go back to the beginning and just get a bit of a handle on your story, right? So you started a business in the sustainability area. Was it Greentricity in uni? Is that right?
That is spot on.
Okay. So tell us about that, because this is back in, I mean, you're not that old, but this is back in 2005, right? So that was fairly... that whole sustainability thing was really at the early stages then, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Actually, the New South Wales government had just come out with a scheme to create...
So these are the carbon credit schemes, estate-based, yeah.
That's right. My dad goes back. My dad was a stockbroker, and he introduced me to some of his stockbroking mates just down the road, actually, in Australia Square.
Right.
And I had never drunk cappuccino before, and took me down, and they got me so buzzed up on caffeine, and I thought this was great. I was so excited by that.
That's great.
And they told me about that they'd seen some of these companies doing you know this stuff in sustainability, and I went home and read up all about it and wrote this proposal to the government to get a license. Ended up getting granted one, and by Joe Tripodi, who later got, I think, done by ICAC for doing some naughty things. But got a license. That business got acquired very soon after, luckily, and I took that money and reinvested into pretty much the same sort of business straight after.
So that's interesting. So you started a business at uni, you developed it, and then you sold it. It's still going, isn't it? I think I looked up on the website.
Well, that business got bought by what is now AGL, so okay. It's still going. It's
well done.
It's been consumed by AGL. I wish I'd held on to my stock, but okay. You know, classic thing that we all do is sell it and reinvest it. Classic thing, Mike, as I'm sure you know from your businesses, is if all I'd done was sit on my stock back then,
yeah,
you know, it would have paid itself.
Yeah, well, it's a sort of Warren Buffett buy, hold, you know, never sell. But so what did you do then? You got out of that, you're in sustainability. I mean, just even going back before that, what do you think? When did you first start thinking you might be an entrepreneur, or that you wanted to do stuff by yourself, for yourself? Well, when did that first germinate, that idea?
Yeah, I think I was at school. I was school captain at Sydney Boys High in 2001, and I ended up, you know, doing a bunch of things at school that I suppose school captains hadn't done for a while.
Okay.
Like turning muck up day into a revenue positive day for the school.
Okay.
But it involved shutting down traffic on Moore Park Road and not letting traffic go until they would actually donate money to a charity.
That's so amazing. So you obviously had a bit of a leader around that idea, and you like to monetize things, right?
Yeah, I think monetization is key. Like, I've done 25 funding rounds now, and I think, you know, all of those, still to this day, I'm back raising money, and if each funding round is as hard as the last one, and it's all, you know, investors are looking for the same thing. They're looking for customers. They're looking for revenue. They're looking for, it's all the stuff you see in businesses on a daily basis, that cash is king. And even in startups, people are looking for, you know, I go back to that company Groupon a while. Like, do you remember Groupon? They were handing out coupons for a while back.
Okay.
And Groupon, they used to pay $100 to get $50 in revenue.
Right.
Needless to say, they went bust pretty
wow,
quick.
My God.
So, you know, and that, I just go back to those sort of things that still applies to startups.
Yeah. So you started your first business, you left it. Then what did you do? So you stayed in the energy game.
I did. I mean, I had some businesses on the side that aren't on my LinkedIn profile. I was laughing because, you know, I saw you had Gino's Pizza. Oh. I actually set up a business called Food by Web.
Did you?
Which was online food ordering. Same time.
So I was a bit before you. So I was in pizza home delivery. So that was before the web, really. But we were taking it from, you know, before deliveries. I mean, people, everything gets delivered now, literally everything. But back in the mid-80s, it was a complete novelty that you could take some food to somebody's address. Like, that was, outside of London, that was just not a thing.
Fantastic. I mean, we did a similar thing, but it was just before the iPhone. But the mistake we made was that our orders were going over fax machine, and the fax machine was still in the office. And so the office closed on Fridays at 3 p.m. generally.
Yeah.
So the kitchen wouldn't get the order. And so that business didn't last too long.
Yeah. Well, my kids have never heard of a fax machine. But that, because they came very quickly and they went just as quickly, didn't they? Yeah. Okay. So you then started that business with the Energy Link, and you were 8 years there. So that was a good body of work, that, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
So that was called CO0.
So as opposed to CO2, we were trying to
CO0.
Have CO0, which was no carbon dioxide. Again, it was based on the trading schemes that existed at the time. And in 2011, that business was the fastest growing company in Australia. I think at that time was on the Young Rich list with my co-founder, which was one of those claim to fame that I'm ashamed to have, because it didn't do anything.
It's only the kiss of death, actually.
It was.
But still impressive, though. So you were really trying to get into that whole helping people calculate their carbon footprint and offsetting it, basically.
Well, we initially were, but then it turned into a trading desk, basically.
Okay.
So we built an app that let you create your rooftop solar credits, your rebate, and then you could then trade that with a corporate that had to buy those rebates to offset their government mandated requirement.
Right.
So not a voluntary requirement, but a government mandated requirement. And at that stage, that was something like, I'm pulling a number out here, but it was something like 8% of their of the electricity they purchased had to be accompanied by their certificates. So that was underpinned by, you know, some regulatory drivers. Needless to say, those regulatory drivers changed as the governments changed.
Yeah.
And that's what ultimately led to me needing to pivot that business in 2012.
Right.
So I had investors at the time. The investors were, one of my investors was a Japanese corporate. The Japanese corporate couldn't understand how a government would change the policy.
Right.
That was unheard of in Japan, under, you know, I think a pretty stable sort of long-term stable regime. So,
but these were state-based legislated schemes that were effectively changing all the time.
Well, state and federal, yes. I mean, they both were, and I know you've got some experience in this through other board directorships with, so you would be familiar with it. But yes, they do change all the time. It's one of the unfortunate things about making long-term investment decisions in this space.
And yes.
I hear it from institutional investors all the time, which is one of the reasons why I left the renewable energy space.
Right.
Is it is just virtually impossible to, you know, I can't imagine being a super fund in Australia and having to make a long-term investment decision in energy.
Right.
Like it's just, you know, it's impossible.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose the advantage of legislation, I mean, I'm on the board of a health, safety and hygiene business. The advantage of legislation for us is that, you know, companies are compelled to do certain things and to keep certain standards, which helps drive our business. The flip side of that is that, you know, when they change, you know, everything can fall apart.
Yeah, and
for a while.
You can make a lot of money or lose a lot of money overnight.
Yeah.
And in our case, we lost a lot of money overnight.
Mm.
And I think it's, you know, it's once bitten, twice shy for me in that space. And it's probably why I moved into one of the most highly regulated spaces, which is financial services.
Okay, yeah. So tell us about that. This is a business that you eventually listed, right?
Yeah. So
this is called Identity.
Double down on the regulation. So Identity, which didn't start, again, I tend to like changing company names, but it didn't. We actually started life as a neobank, believe it or not, in 2014.
So for the uninitiated, what's a neobank, including me, by the way?
A neobank or a challenger bank is their known.
Right, yeah.
So you might be familiar with
it. So not one of the big four.
Yeah, not one of the big four.
Yeah.
And not even one of the big five or six.
No.
But like the UK, your mother tongue, or our mother tongue, I should say, is the leader here with Revolut, Monzo, Starling, these names that some Australians would be familiar with and are probably customers of, they're digital first banks.
Yeah,
so
okay.
You can sign up and get better exchange rates, and they don't have the legacy of
it's all online.
Branches.
They haven't got the costs,
but yeah, they don't have the legacy of
and
branches.
They start doing well, but they normally then get bought by one of the bigger banks, don't they?
Well, they do, but in the case of Revolut, it's an amazing story. I mean, they're now worth more than NatWest,
wow,
RBS.
Is that right?
It's quite phenomenal. I think their last valuation was over 40 billion pounds sterling.
Well, okay. Interesting. No, that's good. I mean, look, we need the banks. You know, we need competition.
Well, you need, and that's the thing that's sort of lacking, I think, in Australia, but which is why I wanted to start a challenger bank. But I couldn't get it funded in Australia. Everyone thought, they said, Nick, what's wrong with the current banking system?
I'll give you a list if you want.
So I had to pivot that business, and the big problem that I identified at the time, and this was actually identified to me by HSBC, who I was working with at the time, was that anti-money laundering fines had just hit $200 billion globally, and that was a big cause of payments being held up. When was the last time you sent money overseas?
Can't remember.
Well, I can tell you that I did it about 6 months ago through a normal bank, and it took 3 days for that money to arrive.
Yes, that's interesting. Actually, I do remember now. I had to send some money to Hong Kong, and I had to put one of my guys on it for a week to get it done because they needed a banker's draft, and everyone had stopped doing them in COVID.
Yeah.
So we had to join the police bank. I couldn't join it because I wasn't an Australian citizen at the time. I am now. But my wife had to join the police bank because they're the only guys who did it. And she joined it just to get the draft so we could send it to Hong Kong. What a bloody bar.
So
they took a week.
They still call it a telegraphic transfer. And you're probably old enough to remember.
Yeah, I remember
the telegraph.
Yeah.
So
dear mom, run out of money. Please send some.
It's all right. So that's a hangover from the time when banks would still, and I'm making a tapping signal for those who can't actually see me, a telegraph would be sent, a wire would be sent between two banks and they would tap.
A bit like Morse code.
It was a Morse code instruction. That's right. And so they would have, and Mike, believe it or not, they'd have a wire room in a bank.
So what was our Identity and what was the genesis of that? then? And how did that evolve? Because it very few people are able to start a business that then they list on the stock exchange. That's a pretty impressive story. So tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I can't claim to have come up with the idea. It was HSBC that turned around and said, Nick, if you can help us solve this money laundering challenge, then we'll become a customer. And I can't necessarily say that we solved it, but what I can say is that you know, we patented the idea, and the company is currently suing JP Morgan for patent infringement at the moment.
Okay, right, okay.
And there's a live case in Delaware at the moment. And
so it was worth summing that patent then, I presume.
Well, it's being litigated.
Someone's trying to protect
currently,
it, yeah.
The case is live. So what's the date today? It's September 20. So, it's currently live. So that could be a large settlement. Who knows? But so HSBC turned around and said, if you can help us solve this challenge. So we were using blockchain technology at the time. Blockchain is a new technology that is the technology that underpins Bitcoin.
Yeah.
It is a shared, we're just having a conversation before the podcast about, you know, technology. And I mean, it's a shared database effectively, like a big Excel spreadsheet that can be viewed by multiple parties. So it's a great technology for sharing data between parties that don't necessarily trust each other, like banks. So we thought, well, great, let's use this technology to help banks share personally identifiable information.
Right.
Things like your passport,
yeah,
your date of birth, your other identifiable information.
Yeah.
The sort of stuff that you had to give police bank.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Because I guarantee the police bank are probably keeping that on a database somewhere within their bank.
Yeah, yeah.
And the reason it took 7 days for that money to clear is because they've had to manually pick up a phone and call HSBC in Hong Kong and tell them that you're, you know, the Michael McGrath that you say they are.
Yeah.
Or they say you are.
Their pastors know our name as well.
Hey? That's right. And they know, they probably know where you live now as well.
Yeah. So you use blockchain, and that was pretty, I mean, blockchain's a real thing, isn't it? I mean, blockchain is extremely widespread now, right?
As a technology, it definitely is. I mean, the thing that I think the general public have sort of, I suppose, forgotten now is because AI has really taken the media's attention, is that the blockchain wave has sort of been forgotten about, and it was the technology that was going to change the world, and now AI has now sort of is now changing the world.
But is AI drawing on the data that the blockchain allows access to, or what?
Oh, listen, I call them all frontier technologies.
Okay.
So I don't necessarily think they're interdependent of each other. I don't necessarily think that they are dependent on each other. They're all frontier technologies. So, you know, most of the big companies, the FANGs or the MANGs, as I think you call them now, they all have large research and development budgets going into all of these frontier technologies.
Right.
So blockchain is definitely not gone by the wayside.
No.
It's just that it's not talked about as much now.
Okay.
Because AI has taken the lead.
And so you solved that problem. So tell us about that business then. So how did you get to list it?
Yeah, so we did the typical sort of seed. Well, you start at pre-seed generally. So, I mean, for those who aren't familiar, you know, the typical sort of fundraising path of a startup is sort of a pre-seed round before you have revenue, a seed round once you've posted some revenue from customers, and then a Series A round once you are ready. We're sort of like the coin, the slot machine. Once you're ready to scale up the business, you found product market fit, you know what your customer acquisition cost is, and you're ready to scale the business. So we did, I would say, up to a Series A funding round, and we kind of got to a point where we had some early investors who were looking for liquidity. So they were looking for the ability to sell their shares. And we wanted to, but we still, the company was hungry for more money. So we had this sort of, we had this difficult situation whereby the board had to kind of manage, you know, how do we deal with the need for more money, but the need to provide liquidity to existing shareholders. And, you know, at the time, there weren't many secondary options available in Australia that there are now. So there are now funds in Australia that will provide, that are secondary funds that will come in and buy out existing shareholders. So there weren't, this was 2018. So there weren't a huge amount of those. And in any event, we were in quite a niche part of the market. If you were in the UK,
yeah,
there are reg tech specific investors.
Yeah.
In Australia, there are generalists.
Okay.
Tech investors. So
you decided to list, right, which is normally a kind of 3-year journey. Well, did you expedite that?
We did, but we didn't do it through a back door.
Okay.
So a lot of people say, oh, Nick, you just, did you do that? No, we did a front door listing.
Is that right?
Okay. So we did a clean, fully regulated listing.
Because that's not cheap. I mean,
it's not cheap and it's not easy. So you know, the ASX has very stringent requirements. They have profit tests, asset tests.
Yeah.
You know, you have to provide 3 years fully audited accounts. You have to provide, you have to have a board of directors that has full qualifications. You have to have directors that have previous experience running listed companies. You have to pass all the probity checks.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not something that I would recommend any small company does. And having been there and done that, you know, the cost, it's not even the cost. It's the time and energy that it takes for management to
jump through all the hoops, basically, and not just initially, but ongoing as well. I mean,
completely. And you know, I had 3,500 shareholders.
Right.
So,
okay,
you know, prior to listing, I had 100.
Wow.
So,
okay,
you know,
so I mean, typically it's $750,000, maybe $1 million to list.
Oh, it was at least that,
was it? And then normally it's the compliance costs are normally $750,000
because you've got to take into account
every year.
Yeah, you've got to take into account broker fees. So, you know, the lawyers, you'd be lucky to get away with $500,000 in legal fees.
So you listed it and then you ran it as a listed business for a while, right?
Well, it's still
going.
Yeah, it's still listed.
One D8 for anyone who's interested.
ID8. ID8,
let's
be. That's right.
Yeah. ID8, okay. And it's a payment data business, basically.
That is correct. Exactly right. So, customers are, there's an announcement today on the market that customers, Bendigo Bank, Rabobank, MasterCard.
And are you still involved there?
I'm not, full disclosure,
okay.
I'm not.
Okay, yeah, no, that's good. Okay. So you kind of moved on from that. I mean, you're piling up a lot of learning here, a lot of lessons, right?
A lot of sleepless nights.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. So bring us to Chirp then. So this is your current venture, how long have you been working on this?
Well, I took some time off between Identity and I did some time in Singapore.
Okay.
With a venture builder run by Temasek, which is a large sovereign wealth fund.
So did you spend some time in Singapore?
I spent about a year.
Because I heard it's really happening there and that there's a lot of Hong Kong money moved there and there's a lot of private equity and family office.
Yeah, they relaxed the laws. Well, they incentivized the laws for family offices to set up in Singapore. So,
right.
I mean, it is and it isn't.
Right.
I think Singapore does a good job of sort of marketing themselves as being open for business, and
right.
And it definitely is open for business. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of early stage venture capital, Australia has a lot of incentives for early stage businesses. We have the research and development tax incentive, which is unmatched In most markets.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
43.5 cents back in the dollar.
Yeah, no, it helps a lot. I mean, I'm on the board of some manufacturing businesses that have really, you know, really been helped by that.
Yeah, yeah. Hugely. So, you know, there's not, I mean, Singapore has some tax grants, but there's nothing like that in Singapore.
No.
There's nothing like that in Hong Kong. Hong Kong has some science development parks that, but you know, for me as a entrepreneur in the early stages, Australia is a pretty damn good place to set up a business.
Okay.
Having said that, you know, developers, I have a lot of software developers in there. When I say a lot, I nothing like I used to have. So, but the costs, that we pay our engineers, in Australia is hasn't really changed much in the last 5 years.
Right.
Maybe it's dropped slightly, but on maybe kept up with inflation. So, but to come back to your question, so I came back the end of last year. So I've been working on this now for about 7 or 8 months.
Okay.
But Mike, this has been 20 years of hard knocks.
Wow. Yeah.
Like in 20 years, I have struggled with founder-led sales, and I've struggled with sales broadly. And I can put it down to two things, really. One is that I haven't qualified deals properly.
Right.
And what do I mean by that? Well, you're probably familiar with these simple, you know, frameworks that we use, qualification frameworks. BANT is the simplest one. Budget, authority, need, and timeline.
Yeah.
And am I talking to somebody, that's got authority?
Yeah.
Is there a burning need for my product?
Yeah.
Is there a timeline to buy?
So this is, as an entrepreneur, you continually, you know, seeing the challenges of trying to secure consistent sales revenue. Because, you know, 90% of business problems are solved by more sales normally, right?
Well, 90% sales solves all problems. Sales solves all problems. And, but
well,
also,
somewhere between 90% and 100%.
That's right. But also, 90% of the solution is to hire more sales reps.
Right.
And that doesn't work.
No. So what you're saying is, with all that pain and all that sort of angst over the last 20 years, you've put that into this solution that you're now calling Chirp, right? Which is the AI.
Sidekick. Just call it a sidekick.
Sidekick to AI. So tell us, you know, I'm running a mid-sized business. I've got 10 reps.
Yeah.
We're trying to get more sales. Tell me what you're going to be able to do for us.
Yeah. So, well, I can tell you what the benefits are.
Yeah.
We're going to help you close deals quicker.
All right. I like the sound of that already.
And we're going to help you improve your win rate.
Okay.
Closing 50% of deals that come into your pipeline from marketing, we'll help you close 75%.
Okay. I like the sound of that. But how are you going to do it?
So we do that in a few different ways. The first one is we help you qualify deals better using a framework like BANT.
Okay.
The way that we qualify better using BANT is we analyze the conversation.
Yeah.
And we pick out words and phrases in the conversation that express budget, authority, need, and time frame. So if you say something like, you know, I don't have any budget, or the converse of that, which is, I've got $20,000 to spend this year. We will pick that out using AI and we'll fill out a little, it's basically a spreadsheet, but it looks a lot prettier than that, but we'll fill that out for you and that'll get updated in your CRM.
Shouldn't my sales guy be listening for that?
Sales people are lazy, Mike. You know that.
And say, he's told me he's got a 20 grand budget, right? So what you're saying is that
we do it for you. The AI does it for you.
You'll monitor those conversations, synthesize all that, and then represent it with the insights.
And fill out the CRM for you.
Okay.
And because
is that right?
Salespeople spend, according to Salesforce, who are just down the road.
Yeah.
Salespeople spend
I helped them build that position.
Great, you did. You contributed towards their retirement plans. But Salespeople spend 72% of their time not selling. So what's that time being spent on? So that time is spent on researching who they're going to meet with, like finding out that you set up Gino's Pizza.
Yeah.
Matt, filling out a CRM.
Yeah.
And taking notes during meetings and basically typing up those notes.
Right.
And then basically, booking follow-up meetings, sending case studies, writing emails, doing all that sort of stuff.
So effectively, if we want to engage with your business, your new business, Chirp, we're buying a platform. Is it a platform?
It's software as a
plugin.
It's software as a service.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if you've got a CRM, this is a plugin.
It sits on top of your CRM, again, it's a sidekick or a co-pilot. And our view at the moment is that the CRM is only one part of the sales, what we call the sales stack, or the tools that you have in the sales suite these days. There's often there's marketing software, there's email, there's calendar booking tools, there's a call recording tool, and there's prospecting tools, etc. So we orchestrate all of that together, and then, as I mentioned, we overlay this qualification framework, and then the other thing that we'll do is automate the research on who you're meeting with for you. So we use ChatGPT to crawl out to all of the different public data sources to find out exactly who you're meeting with. And so we can find out things like, what school they went to, what they studied at university, what sports they played, what they like doing in their spare time, whether they ran a marathon last weekend, boards they're on. So
you synthesize all that public information effectively.
We do.
Cutting down the time that a rep or a sales person has to spend pulling that together.
That's right.
And if he pulls it together at all.
That's right. So typically, most people will go to LinkedIn before they go to a meeting, and you might do that 10 minutes before you go to a meeting. We can find you a lot more than you would in LinkedIn. I can tell you if a company has just raised a round of funding, if they're about to go bust, if they're,
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. So effectively, this is a bolt-on, as you said. It goes over the top of your CRM, and then pulls together the various tools, including the CRM, but not just the CRM, to help synthesize and cut down
synthesize and qualify deals.
That's right. Okay.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. And then there's a third part, which happens after the meeting, and that's what we call next best action.
Right.
And that really is just telling you what we think you should do next, or what the AI thinks you should do next.
Right.
To help close the deal.
Yeah.
Now, Mike, as someone that's been doing this for a very long time, you will know what to do next, naturally. But your juniors might not.
No.
So
well, I'm not sure I do either. But yeah, okay, I've got the point. So ostensibly, this is this is bringing AI to life, really. This is saying...
This is a good use case for AI. This is a real, tangible use case for AI. And I'm going to throw another buzzword in here just for good measure. This is what we call agentic AI. So agentic AI is the next evolution of ChatGPT. So ChatGPT is a large language model. It gives you context. So you can use it to find context and to ask it a question. It can't book you a flight. But what Chirp can do is take an action for you.
Right.
So it can write you an email.
Right.
Or it can book you a meeting with someone.
Right.
Or it can actually take an action.
Okay.
So the next evolution of what we call these AI agents is this agentic AI, and that's the space we play in.
Have you got productivity cases for that? I mean, does that save? I mean, that obviously saves time, but does that start saving money?
Well, our play is a revenue gain, so we say we make you more money.
So it's not necessarily less staff. It's effectively more revenue.
It's more revenue
per member.
That's right. Mm. So keep your 10 sales reps.
Yeah.
You're gonna uplift your revenue by. I mean, I can't give you the exact numbers now because we're only 7 months in. But if as I said before, if you're doing a 50% win rate, if you can take that to 75% win rate, do the numbers on that.
So for anyone listening to this, right, what's the best sort of company that can, where's your sweet spot and where do you think this technology and these tools are most effective?
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you that we, Chirp, are targeting B2B SaaS companies, software companies, and we just have to be quite specific on who we target because we're very small and we've only just started out. But it's 5 to 20 sales reps. So that's where we think we can help the most. But I think more broadly, the AI agents can really help anyone that's got a CRM in place and that is looking at automation in their sales stack. So if you are using a call recording tool and you're using some sort of marketing automation software, so you're doing outbound emails, you're doing any type of outbound cold calling, that type of thing, then I think AI agents can help. Now, Chirp might not be, the software for you today, but, my hope is that we'll grow over very quickly. I hope there will be an Aussie success story because I'm not here to fuck around.
So it's a SaaS model, right? So effectively...
Yeah, it's a simple SaaS
model. Yeah, so, the technology gets loaded... Someone pays monthly.
Yeah, it's a monthly. Now I'll just qualify that.
Is it per user or?
It's a per user per month, but there's a consumption charge as well that kicks in over a number of meetings. Now, there's the reason there's a consumption charge is because AI is one of these, as your listeners would know, is one of these things where there's a large computing cost to this. So, We have to pass on some of that. We can't consume all that because the more people use our software, the more we get charged. Software typically has had a very high gross profit margin, upwards of 90% typically. Software as a service, that is. Now, that's not the case with AI compute. It is very expensive. It will come down over time, but it's not there yet.
No, okay. Okay. So effectively it's a monthly
cost per user.
And the more you use it,
it kicks in over a certain level. Yeah. That's okay. Right.
Interesting. And so where do you think all this is going? I mean, do you think that, there's a lot spoken about AI at the moment. A lot of people worried about it. A lot of people think it's going to get out of control. Well, what's your own view?
Well, I've just come back from San Francisco literally last week, where I was. I had the fortune or misfortune to jump in a self-driving car that was run by Waymo, which is a subsidiary of Google. And I was just saying to Simon, one of your colleagues, that it's quite disconcerting because they've left the steering wheel on. Which baffles me why they would leave the steering wheel on a self-driving car. the only reason I could think of is that if a car happens to go haywire and starts veering off the road, you can...
So where did you sit, in the front or the back?
I sat in the back. I sat as far away from the controls as possible because I'm a very bad backseat driver.
I presume the brake in the passenger seat doesn't work.
No, it doesn't.
The same as in my car.
Although I think they do say in the instructions when you sit in there that if it does happen to start mowing people down on the road that you can override the controls.
That's pretty scary, that idea that the roads could be full of cars.
Well, it's happening. It's not scary. Well, it is scary, but it's happening.
Well, I know it's something on the mine sites because I'm involved in a company that's providing the aftermarket harnesses and technology, and that's been going for quite a while.
Yes, it's been going for more over 10 years, I think, because I remember
someone. So the technology isn't new. It's more around what people will accept.
That's right. And trucking, I think, is the sixth largest employer in the US or transport. You'll have to fact check that on me. Do you fact check? I don't know.
No, look, we do. I mean, we do if there's money involved.
There's no money enough for
okay,
me.
Fair enough.
I don't own a trucking company.
No, I mean, we try.
Are you selling a trucking company?
No, we try and get our... Actually, we're not keen on transport. The margins are quite tight. There's some nice niches, but generally we stay away from haulage, really.
Understood. It's a pretty, heavily dominated market.
Yeah, very important and expanding, actually.
Yes.
So we like some of the supply, we call it... mops and buckets. So we like the supply side to that, the manufacturers, trailers, tippers, tankers, that world's, you know, growing because there's more and more moving by road, especially in Australia. It's a big country, there's population's growing, so that's more movement. And we don't have much of a train infrastructure to speak of, really. Mm. So the roads are still the king here.
Mm. Well, I think that's where we may start to see some of this happening because I know that Google is definitely looking into self-driving truck infrastructure. But I also tried on the Apple Vision Pro while I was in San Francisco, and I can tell you as an early adopter of the Oculus Rift.
What's that? Just
that's
for
the 3D vision goggles.
Yeah.
So Apple's Vision Pro is their new 3D goggles, but I'm not doing it justice by saying that, but it's just incredible. I mean, the implications that this will have for retail and FMCG is huge.
Is that right?
I mean, like you can do, and training businesses, for example, like you could run a full training course through these goggles. If I was, you know, I think back to doing a course at McDonald's that, you know, I don't think I ever did, but you could run a full course, you know, through these goggles and it's just phenomenal. So
it's a sort of simulation, you know, being able to replicate, you know,
real world scenarios,
environments,
hazardous environments,
interesting.
Confrontational environments.
Oh, okay.
Yes, it's just so. I think, you know, the sort of doom and gloom scenarios that are painted, that, you know, AI is going to sort of
and the end is nigh.
Yeah, the end is nigh. I think where we may end up is sort of in this, you know, leisure generation where we're all going to end up as drug addicts and sex addicts. You know, I don't think that's necessarily a reality.
I hope not.
Right. So maybe we just end up with, you know, we only have to work 4 hours a day.
Yeah.
And I'd be quite happy to go sailing on the harbour.
Yeah, yeah. Well, most of my stuff anyway will work 4 hours a day anyway.
Yes.
As my dad used to say, when you say, how many people work here? About half of them.
Well, you're the chairman now, aren't you?
Right,
so
you
probably play golf.
You're joking. I'm the executive chairman. That's preserved for the non-executive chairman. I'm still hard at it. Okay, well, that's been fascinating. Well, we wish you all the best with Chirp. And it's been interesting to hear a little bit about your 20-year journey. I'm sure there's lots of other stories that we could have gone into, but we're out of time. But again, Nick, thanks for coming in, and all the best to you and to Chirp. And for anyone who's listening, if you've got some sales reps and you want to start improving your productivity, why don't you give Nick Armstrong
the website is trychirp.com.
There you go. That's easy enough. Even I can do that. Trychirp.com.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Okay, thank
Appreciate
you. It. Bye. Well, there you have it. There's no stopping Nick Armstrong. If you want to know more about Chirp, the details will be in the show notes. Now, if you're enjoying this content, be sure to tell your friends and those who may also enjoy the content. Thanks for listening. Until next time.